middle of the lot and stomped his foot against the tail of the board, flipping it up into his hand. He stood like that, calmly, and stared at our apartment door. Had he seen me? Had he recognized me? Had he come here because he was looking for us? But how had he known where we lived? Had he followed us that day after the gas station? I was breathing fast. Calm down, Alma, I told myself. Maybe it's only a coincidence. Maybe it's not even the same boy. But when I curled around the side of the window again to peer at him, I was sure. I could see the tattoo, the navy blue ink of it winding up his neck. He didn't move for at least 5 minutes. I kept expecting him to turn around to look at the other apartments, but he only stood with his hand gripping the top of his skateboard and stared at our door, as if he were waiting for us. For Maribel. At last he spit on the ground and dropped the skateboard with a clatter. He turned around and pushed off, jumping the curb at the edge of the lot, and glided down to the gravel. I took a deep breath. What had that been about? Was it only that he liked Maribel, or was there something else? When I was sure he was gone, I stepped back outside. At the end of the balcony, a man was standing with his arms crossed, looking grimly at the parking lot. As soon as he saw me, he raised his hand above his head and waved. I nodded, and he walked toward me.
I was just coming to find you, he said. I'm the landlord. Vito Angelino at your service. I have your mailbox key.
He pulled a small brass key out of the chest pocket of his shirt and handed it to me.
Thank you, I said quietly, dropping it into my purse. You are okay? Vito asked.
He was slender and sinewy with a pointy gray goatee.
Yes, I said. I thought I saw someone. You mean that boy? On his skateboard just now? Vito shook his head. Just a local troublemaker. Un alborotador. He's always hanging around by the Shell station. The 7-Eleven, too. He lives in Capitol Oaks down the road.
Vito looked over his shoulder in the direction the boy had gone.
I don't know what he was doing here.
When Vito turned back to me, he said brightly,
But don't worry, senora. He's nothing to worry about.
I nodded slowly, wanting to believe him.
You're going somewhere, Vito asked. I don't know, I said. You're coming from somewhere, then?
No.
I see. You are confused, Vito chuckled. Fortunately for you, this is not a confusing area. You have Main Street and all the university students. You have Hockessin with all the gringos. Downtown Wilmington is where most of the blacks live, and Greenville is where all the rich white people stay. Ellesmere and Newport are for the lower class. It's all very simple.
And here, I asked?
Here is us. Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, Mexico, Panama, and Paraguay. We have it all.
All in this building?
You'll fit right in, Vito said.
He was jumpy and quick, all sharp angles and sudden movements. I didn't know what to make of him. But there was a certain comfort that came with hearing someone speak Spanish. To understand and to be understood. To not have to wonder what I was missing.
And don't give a second thought to that boy, he went on. It's safe here. Very safe.
I realized that Vito was concerned that he'd scared me away, and that if he had, he would lose out on the rent he would be getting from us.
Nothing to worry about, he said again. Yes?
Nothing to worry about, I said, testing the words on my tongue to see if they felt true.
Mayor. I expected to run into the Rivera girl at school. Not right away, obviously. But sooner or later, all the kids who moved into our part of town showed up at school. When Fernando Ramos walked into homeroom the first day of freshman year, he told the teacher to call him adios, because that's what she'd be saying to him soon anyway. We never stay anywhere for long, he explained. When Lucia Castillo got here, she spent the whole year as a mute, shuffling from class to class and eating the food her mom made her, pinto beans and rice and tamales, by herself in the corner of the cafeteria. And when Eddie Pabon arrived, he was so excited to be in the United States and out of Guatemala that he took the concept of educational opportunity to another level, another planet, and joined every single one of the 14 clubs at our school, started playing the trumpet in the band, lettered in 3 sports, volunteered as a hall monitor during his free period, and cozied up to the teacher so much that by the end of the first marking period, he was having bagels with them in the morning in the lounge. People started calling him Lambón Pabón, a nickname he accepted like it was an honor to be called a suck-up. "You have anyone new in your classes?" I asked my friend William one day. We were sitting in chemistry lab, waiting to see what happened when we mixed silver nitrate and salt. Everyone had on goggles, and the girls had spent the beginning of class complaining that the elastic straps were messing up their hair. Mine didn't even have a strap, so I had to hold them against my face with my hand. "There's always someone new," William said. "Can't keep track of them." "A girl." "Way to narrow it down." "Her last name is Rivera," I said. "I think she's Mexican." "No shit. Rivera sounded Chinese to me." William grinned, and his braces glinted under the fluorescent lights. He was skinny, like me, but he was pale, and his brown hair flopped down over his forehead. "She moved into my building last week." "So?" "But I haven't seen her at school yet. So I was wondering if you'd seen her." William snickered. "Oh, I get it now. She must be hot." "I hardly even saw her." "Is she a hot taquito?" "You're a jackass." "A hot little taquito for little Mayorito." He cracked up at himself, all warm and soft inside. I crossed my arms. My goggles fell onto the table. "Forget I even asked," I muttered. I had stopped going to soccer practice after the day I crashed and burned in the star drill. I just didn't have it in me to show my face there again. I also didn't have it in me to break the news to my dad, who'd been especially moody and tense lately because he was worried about losing his job at the diner where he worked as a line cook. So for now, I was pretending like I was still on the team. Every morning, I packed my gym bag, and every night over dinner, I told my parents about the drills Coach had us doing to gear up for our big games, or about Jamal Blair's crazy bicycle kick near the end of a scrimmage, or about whatever else I imagined was happening on the field without me. I probably didn't need to try so hard. My parents were so wrapped up in their own problems that they barely even registered me. My mom had decided that she should get a job just in case my dad really did lose his, an idea that my dad found unacceptable. "I am the provider," he said over and over. "That's all there is to it." My mom kept having phone conversations with my tía Gloria in Panama, the two of them brainstorming about positions my mom might qualify for. I'd overhear my mom saying things like, "I'm a very capable woman," and, "Is it a crime that I should want to help my family?" And, "Claro, my life is not only about fulfilling his life, but try getting him to see it that way." Once, after my dad caught an earful of their conversation, he rushed over to the phone base and stabbed the button down with his finger to disconnect the call. I was sitting at the kitchen table. My mom looked at him in shock. "Those phone calls cost a lot of money," he said. To which my mom, the receiver still in her hand, the coiled cord stretched across the room, said, "We could afford them if you would let me get a job." To which my dad thundered, "Ya! Basta, Celia! I don't want to hear about it anymore." which set my mom wailing, and him bellowing in return. The day I finally met the Rivera girl, I'd broken free of my parents' latest argument to sit outside on the curb and play Tetris on my phone when my mom stormed out. "Ving," she said when she saw me.
"Where?"
"I can't be in that apartment anymore."
"But where are we going?"
"Anywhere," she said. We ended up at the Dollar Tree, mostly because the day before, someone had stolen our entire load of laundry from the washing machine at the laundromat. Along with a pair of my mom's pajama pants and a few pairs of my boxers, my dad's dingy white briefs and white undershirts had been in the load too. But my mom, in her simmering anger toward him, told me on the bus on the way to the store that he could buy his own underwear if he wanted it.
"He's so good at doing everything for himself, let him do that too," she said.
We were walking through the aisles, me with an Econo pack of boxers under my arm like a pillow, when I caught sight of her. She was skinny and petite, big full lips, and a long thin Indian nose, black hair that reached down her back in waves, long as hell eyelashes. I stopped and stared. She was standing in the aisle with all the cheap dinnerware, looking bored, while her mom turned over a package of plastic silverware.
"What?"
my mom said, glancing at me.
"Nothing," I mumbled, and made a move to keep walking. But my mom backtracked to see what had snagged my attention.
"Who is that?" I tried to distance myself further. I would just talk to her another time, I thought, preferably one when my mom wasn't around.
"Are those our new neighbors?"
my mom asked. And before I knew it, she was marching toward them, her pocketbook bouncing against her thigh.
"Buenas,"
she said when she reached them. The mother turned, surprised.
"I'm Celia Toro, and this is my son Mayor," my mom said in Spanish. "You live in our apartment building, no? The Redwood Apartments?"
Señora Rivera smiled. She was small and plump. Her wavy black hair was slicked back in a ponytail.
"Ah, sí, Redwood. I'm Alma Rivera, and this is Maribel."
"Maribel," I said to myself. Forget about how she was dressed. White canvas sneakers straight out of another decade, and a huge yellow sweater over leggings. And forget about the fact that her black hair was mussed, like she'd just woken up, and the fact that she wasn't wearing any makeup or jewelry or anything else that most of the girls in my school liked to pile on. Forget about all of that. She was fucking gorgeous. My heart was jackhammering so hard I thought people from the next aisle were going to start complaining about the noise. Then I remembered the package of underwear I was carrying. In case there was any question, across the front of the plastic in big black letters, it was labeled boxer shorts, size X small. I shuttled the package behind my back.
"I hope you're not looking for food," my mom said. "You won't find much of it in this store. There's a Mexican market nearby, though. Gigante. It probably has everything you're looking for."
"We bought food at the gas station," Señora Rivera said.
"The gas station? I know. And what have you been eating for dinner, gasoline?"
This was my mom's attempt at a joke, and thankfully, Señora Rivera laughed.
"Almost as bad," she said. "Canned beans and hot dogs and something the Americans call salsa."
"Wait until you try the American tortillas," my mom said.
"Horrible."
I was trying not to look at Maribel, or at least to pretend like I wasn't looking, but my gaze kept brushing over her, watching as she stood still, her hands folded in front of her. I thought I should probably say something to her, you know, just to be neighborly, but she was clearly so far out of my league that I was having trouble remembering how to work my mouth. I put one hand in my pants pocket, trying to seem cool. She didn't even look at me. Whatever I said, it had to be good, something that would make her think I had game. Finally, I blurted out, "You just moved in." Señora Rivera glanced at me, Maribel barely looked up. Great. I was an asshole. You just moved in? That's what I'd come up with? To our building, I went on. Jesus. She stared at me, her face as blank as a wall. Yeah, I said, and looked at my feet in humiliation. What was wrong with me? I should just keep my mouth shut from now on, which is exactly what I did after that. Our moms talked while I stared at my shoes, my brother's old black and white Adidas that I always thought looked cool and retro, but at the moment just seemed stupid and old, and counted the minutes until we could get out of there. Then, through my fog of embarrassment, I heard her mom say something about the Ever School. I looked up and saw my mom raise her eyebrows. Did you say Evers? Yes, Senora Rivera said. I looked at the girl again. Evers? That was the school for retards. We all called it the Turtle School. My mom said, Of course, yes, that's a great school. She'll be very happy there. And smiled a little too big. The girl pulled her arms all the way into the body of her yellow sweater so that the empty sleeves hung like banana peels. And I saw it was true. There was something wrong with her. I never would have guessed it. I mean, to look at her, it didn't seem possible. My mom changed the subject after that, telling Señora Rivera where to find the cheapest hair salon and the best Goodwill and how to get to the nearest Western Union. She told her to steer clear of the sandwich shop at the end of Main Street because Inez Mercado, who lived in our building, had found a hair in the hoagie she'd bought there. And of course, she told her about the horrors we'd just experienced with the laundromat. Señora Rivera repeated, Thank you, anytime my mom gave her an opening. And finally, my mom wrapped up by telling her our unit number and encouraging them to stop by any time. I'm almost always home, she said. I guess she couldn't help herself, because she added pointedly, My husband likes it that way.
Benny Quinto. My name is Benny Quinto. I came from Nicaragua, baby. A land of lakes and volcanoes. Been here 8 years, almost to the day. Back in Nicaragua, I was studying to be in the priesthood. I thought I heard God calling my name from up in the clouds somewhere, man. And I thought he was telling me I was the chosen one. This deep, booming voice. I wasn't even high. Drugs hadn't come into my life yet. But I think I must have been hallucinating or something because I've had conversations with God since then, and he's like, Nope, don't know what you're talking about, Benny. Never said all that about you being the one. Sorry to disappoint. A few buddies of mine left Nicaragua to come make some real bones over here. Wasn't no money for pinoleros like us back home. Politically, you know, it wasn't so bad anymore. Somoza was long gone, the Contras were nothing but in memory, but leaving the poverty of Nicaragua to go to the richest country in the world didn't take much convincing. I left when I was 20. Told a dude I would pay him $2,000 to bring me over. $300 up front. Took me a while to scrape it together. $300? In Nicaragua? You could live off that for a while. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I stole some of it from the church. Stuffed the offering envelopes up under my shirt 1 week when I was supposed to be doing my Eucharistic minister duties. And walked out with it. I was gonna do what I had to. I'm like that. Get something in my head and it's like some kind of block. No way to get around it. I just have to bulldoze through. I got shunted into this house in Arizona until I could pay the rest of the money. I mean, they told us we were in Arizona. It was me and 12 other guys, but we could have been in Russia for all we knew. We could have still been in Mexico, which is where we had to come up through to get over. It's like a funnel. Would have been nice if Nicaragua bordered with the U.S., but it doesn't. So up through Mexico I went. That house in Arizona, that place was intense. I didn't see the sun for like weeks. And Arizona is one of those places that might as well be on the sun. That's how sunny it is. So it's nuts that we never saw it. The blinds were shut, and there were heavy bedspreads over all the windows. And me and those guys, we were like cockroaches, crawling over each other at all hours of the day. There was no room to move. Just sit tight, keep the faith. I don't even know why we had to pay so much money. I mean, it wasn't no Ritz-Carlton. Wasn't even no Ritz Cracker Box. But that's the thing. It's just extortion, top to bottom. I wanted to get the hell out of there, so I called an uncle I used to be close with. I mean, he used to come to my birthday parties when I was a kid, and he would take me to the beach sometimes and let me play in the water while he smoked and hit on girls. But he didn't have the funds. I didn't even bother to ask my mom and pop. Those two never had nothing. You know how the gringos say it. No dinero, muchacho. If that weren't the truth, I never would have left Nicaragua to begin with. One of the guys in the house started dealing for the smugglers. He earned out his fee in 2 weeks. I didn't know how else I was going to get out of there, so I signed up too. Figured I'd burn through it, you know, just get it done. Until I had enough to leave, and then I'd be on to bigger and better things. Problem is, you get a taste for that kind of money, and it's hard to go back to anything else. I was out on the streets in Phoenix. We had certain places we always hit up. White kids who wanted to score came with their parents' money rolled up in their fists, acting all sly as they handed it over, thinking they were so street. But the truth was, you could name your price with those kids, and whatever you told them, they would pay. They didn't know any better, most of them. There were some real junkies who came by, too. Some pretty hard dudes. I got tangled up with a few of them once. Just a stupid fight. And the next thing I knew, I woke up one morning busted out of my mind, bleeding on my side. I'd been stabbed and didn't even know it. That's when I decided it had to end. I hitched a ride out of Arizona with a guy who was driving to Baltimore. But the drug scene there was wicked. 10 times worse than in Arizona. I was trying so hard to be on the straight and narrow. I was talking to God about it all the time. I was like, where's your deep voice now, God, when I really need help? And then I swear I heard it. He told me to split. To where? I asked him. Funny thing about God, though, he doesn't always give you the answers, not right when you ask for them anyway. 'Cause I didn't hear nothing. But I knew. I gotta leave. So I went down to the Greyhound station and said, here's how much money I have. Give me a ticket. And the bus brought me to Delaware. It's not paradise, but at least here I can be at peace. It was never like that for me in Nicaragua, and not at my first few stops here, neither. I flip burgers now at the King. Used to be at Wendy's, but they gave me, oh man, the worst shifts. So I switched it up. A person needs regular sleep, you know? I ain't getting any younger. But I feel settled here. I took a couple nasty turns, but I ended up all right.
Alma. Maribel took achievement tests and cognitive tests. She went through evaluations with both a psychologist and an educational diagnostician. They gave her written exams in Spanish to see whether she could write a sentence, whether she could write a paragraph, whether she could do certain math problems. We had a meeting where the psychologist asked if there had been any complications while I was pregnant with Maribel. She asked if Maribel had met her developmental milestones as a child. When did she start to talk? When did she start to walk? Phyllis sat next to me, translating everything. Frustrated, I replied, she wasn't born like this. It's all just because of the accident. Don't you see it in the reports? And the psychologist said, yes, yes, she saw it. But these were standard questions that she was required to ask. And then, after everything, the district told us what we already knew. Maribel had a traumatic brain injury that was classified as mild, but it was severe enough that she was eligible for special education services. She would be transferred to Evers. I nearly wept with joy when I heard the news. Now I thought, finally, we would move forward. They sent a different bus to get her, one that was stumpy and brown. I saw her off the first day and was waiting for her when she came home that afternoon. How was it? I asked.
What?
How was school?
Fine.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
I'm tired, she said.
And I nodded, deflated because I had expected more. I had expected her to come home full of energy, gushing about the other students and her teacher and how much she had learned. I had wanted the school to act like a switch, something that would turn her on again from the second she walked through the door. Give it time, Arturo told me later that night when he detected the disappointment in my voice. You're always so impatient. It was only the first day. Every afternoon, Maribel brought home reports from the school that Phyllis translated into Spanish. They were formal and brief and said things like, Maribel is unresponsive and unengaged, even when she is directly addressed in Spanish. She is withdrawn and rarely interacts with other students, even in activities that require no verbal communication. Maribel has a limited attention span and often fiddles with her pencil or other desk supplies during class time. Day after day, I read the letters, hoping for better news, trying to believe that eventually it would come. After school, I sat with Maribel at the kitchen table and helped her with her homework. In addition to everything else, she was expected to learn English. And one day, the teacher sent home an English worksheet with 9 boxes, each filled with a drawing of a face making a different expression. At the top of the sheet was a story in Spanish about a young Chinese boy, Yu Li. Do you know who this is? I asked Maribel. She shook her head. Can you read the story?
Okay.
I waited while she stared at the paper. Was she reading, I wondered, or just looking at the words? I said, why don't you read it out loud? She did, although haltingly. I had to help her with any word longer than 4 letters. It was a story about how Yu Li came to the United States from China with his parents. He went to school one day, and some of the kids taunted him and some of them were kind, but Yu Li didn't know English, so he was bewildered. When Maribel was finished, I said, now you need to write down words that describe how Yu Li was feeling in the story. Maribel looked at me. There was an eyelash on her cheek. I picked it off and held it on the tip of my finger, then blew it away. Do you remember what happened in the story? What was one emotion Yu Li felt?
I don't know.
But you read the story to me.
I don't remember.
Do you need to read it again?
I already read it.
I know, but you said you didn't remember anything.
Okay.
Maribel, how did Yu Li feel in the story? She shrugged. Do you remember when he went to school?
Yes.
And what happened to him at school?
I don't know.
Were the kids nice to him?
Yes.
And how do you think that made Yu Li feel?
Who is Yu Li?
I took a deep breath. It's okay, Alma, I told myself. It's only the beginning of the year. She's just getting started. When Arturo came home later and kicked off his boots, he asked what we were working on.
I don't know, Maribel said.
Math, he guessed.
Yes, she said.
We are working on English today, I said.
English?
Arturo beamed.
Once you learn English, you can teach it to me too. Here, does this sound like something?
Howdy there, partner.
He made a clownish face, and I knew he was trying to get Maribel to laugh.
trying to extract the tiniest hint of the girl she used to be. It was something we both did. We cast lines out again and again, hoping to reel something in, anything to sustain us. But she never bit. Arturo said, "Did you hear me?"
"Yes."
"Did that sound like English?"
"No."
"What?" he said, acting shocked.
"It sounded good to me," I said.
"Thank you," he said. I wanted him to come to me, to take my hands and kiss my fingers, to run his thumb over my lips, but those weren't the sorts of things we did anymore. He peeled off his socks and unbuttoned his shirt.
"Dinner will be ready soon," I said. "I made tacos de bistec."
He leaned his boots against the wall. "Okay." I waited for more. I was desperate for more. But he only pushed his boot back with his toe when it started to slip and walked down the hall to shower. During the day, I kept myself busy by cleaning and watching television. I had found a Spanish language channel that, if I angled the antenna just right, I could see through the static. I cooked lunch for myself, pork and beans, or chicken basted in onions and orange juice, or on days when I was feeling lazy, soup from a can, and sat at the table alone eating it. I got up afterwards and cleaned again. Once I used the prepaid cell phone we had bought in a market in Pátzcuaro and called my parents, even though the phone was supposed to be reserved for emergencies only. We had called them just after we arrived to tell them we got here safely, but we hadn't spoken again since. My mother shrieked when she heard my voice, and I laughed at hearing my father in the background dashing to my mother in alarm, asking what was wrong. They wanted to know how we were doing, what it was like here, how Maribel was adjusting. I imagined the two of them crowded around the receiver in their small kitchen. The kitchen I had grown up eating in, with its half-moon window over the sink, and the clay rooster my mother kept on the counter next to her bean pot, and a jelly jar filled with flowers. How far away it seemed. My mother brought me up to date on the latest gossip from town. Reina Ortega finally had her baby, and they'd been invited to the bautismo. A new assistant chef had started at Mistongo. Two hogs had gotten loose from the Cotima farm. But hearing it all only made me feel more disconnected from Pátzcuaro. Oddly disappointed to hear that life was going on even without us there. In the 2 weeks since we'd been in the apartment, many of the neighbors, mostly the women, had stopped by to introduce themselves. Quisqueya Solis arrived with a platter of coconut cookies in her arms. Besitos de coco, she told me. And when I invited her in, she walked through the apartment slowly, letting her gaze sweep over our few pieces of furniture, and then refused to sit when I offered a chair, explaining as she patted her fiery red hair that she had errands to run. Nelia Safon knocked on the door and clasped one of my hands between hers, apologizing for taking so long to stop by and assuring me that everyone was happy to have us here. Inez Mercado stood in the doorway and told me if there was anything we needed not to hesitate to ask. I explained that we had acquired some things along the way, but when she heard that Arturo, Maribel, and I were sharing one mattress, she insisted on bringing over an old sleeping bag she and her husband had. "It's from Jose's Navy days," she said. "It kept him safe, and it will keep whoever sleeps in it safe, too." I smiled and said, "Thank you. That sounds perfect for Maribel." When no one came, I went out determined to explore and acclimate myself to the town. A few times, I went to the laundromat, despite Celia's warning.
It was still the nearest one, and sat with my hands in my lap while the load ran, watching the clothes spin and the porthole dryers lined up along the back wall. People walked in and out. A brown-skinned man chewing a toothpick. A motorcyclist wearing a leather vest. A woman with two children, their baskets hoisted up against their stomachs, their clothes spilling over the sides like seaweed. I yearned for them to talk to me, especially anyone who looked as though they might speak Spanish. I readied myself to say, hola, if anyone so much as glanced my way, but day after day people walked by without acknowledging me in the least. I walked to Gigante some afternoons and pulled mangoes and chiles from wooden crates, holding them to my nose, inhaling the sense of home. In the back, I stared at the fish and the lobsters in their giant glass tank, and when the man behind the meat counter asked in Spanish if there was something he could get me, everything was recién matada, fresh, he assured me. I told him, no. Too expensive, I said, smiling sheepishly. We have a sale, he said. It's only for beautiful women. And I laughed in spite of myself. And sometimes I went to the small church we had found, St. Thomas More Oratory, with its water-stained drop ceiling and its folding chairs in place of pews, and sat alone in the empty sanctuary, reciting the same prayers over and over, imploring God to listen. I know I'm not very important, I told him. I know you have other things to worry about, but please, forgive me for all that I've done. Please give me the strength to fix it. Please let her get better. And please let Arturo forgive me too. In Jesus' name, amen. One afternoon, I made chicharrones and carried them over to Celia's apartment. She clapped her hands together in delight when she saw me and motioned for me to come inside. These are for you, I said, holding out a foil-covered plate. She lifted a corner of the foil and sniffed. Oh, sabroso, she said. I loved how full her home felt. Embroidered pillows on the couches. A curio stacked with milk glass bowls and recuerdos and folded tablecloths. Red votives along the windowsills. Spidery potted plants. Woven rugs. Unframed posters of Panama beaches on the walls. A box of rinsed beer bottles on the floor. A small radio on top of the refrigerator, a plastic bag filled with garlic hanging from a doorknob, a collection of spices clustered on a platter on the counter. The great accumulation of things almost hid the cracks in the walls and the stains on the floor and the scratches that clouded the windows. Mi casa es tu casa, Celia joked as I looked around. Isn't that what the Americans say? She poured cold, crackling Coca-Colas for both of us, and we sat on the couch, sipping them and taking small bites of the chicharrones. She looked just as she had the first time I met her. Impeccably pulled together, with a face full of makeup, fuchsia lips, chestnut-brown chin-length hair curled at the ends and tucked neatly behind her ears, small gold earrings. So unlike most of my friends at home who used nothing but soap on their faces and aloe on their hands, and who kept their hair pulled into ponytails like mine, or simply combed after it had been washed and left to air dry. Celia told me about the provisions we would need for winter. Heavy coats and a stack of comforters and something called long underwear that made me laugh when she tried to describe it. And about a place called the community house where they offered immigrant services if we needed them. She gossiped about people in the building, telling me that Nelia Zafón was in a relationship with a gringo half her age, and that when they first came here, Celia's husband Rafael thought José Mercado was gay.
Celia said. He and Inez have been married for more than 30 years, she laughed. She told me about Micho Alvarez, who she claimed always wore his camera around his neck, had a sensitive side despite the fact that he might look big and burly, and that Benny Quinto, who was close friends with Micho, had studied to be a priest years ago. She said that Quisqueya dyed her hair, which was hardly news. I had assumed as much when I met her. It's the most unnatural shade of red, Celia said. Rafael says it looks like she dumped a pot of tomato sauce on her head, she chortled. Quisqueya is a busybody. But it's only because she's so insecure. She doesn't know how to connect with people. Don't let her put you off. Celia began telling me about when she and Rafael and her boys had come here from Panama 15 years ago, after the invasion. So, your son, he was born there, I asked? I have two boys, she said. Both of them were born there. Enrique, my oldest, is away at college on a soccer scholarship. And there's Mayor, who you met. He's nothing at all like his brother. Rafa thinks we might have taken the wrong baby home from the hospital, she forced a smile. Just a joke, of course. She stood and lifted a framed picture from the end table. This is from last summer, before Enrique went back to school, she said, handing it to me. Micho took it for us. In the photo were two boys, Mayor, whom I recognized from the store. Small for his age, with dark, buzzed hair and sparkling eyes, and Enrique, who stood next to his brother with his arms crossed, the faint shadow of a mustache above his lip. What about you, Celia asked. Do you have other children besides your daughter? Only her, I said, glancing at my hands around the glass. The perspiration from the ice had left a ring of water on the thigh of my pants. And she's going... Celia trailed off as though she didn't want to say it out loud. To Evers. Celia nodded. She looked like she didn't know what to say next, and I felt a mixture of embarrassment and indignation. It's temporary, I said. She only has to go there for a year or two. You don't have to explain it to me. She's going to get better. I've heard it's a good school. I hope so. It's why we came. Celia gazed at me for a long time before she said, When we left Panama, it was falling apart. Rafa and I thought it would be better for the boys to grow up here. Even though Panama was where we had spent our whole lives. It's amazing, isn't it, what parents will do for their children? She put her hand on mine. A benediction. From then, we were friends. I was tired of going to my usual places, so one rainy morning, I went instead to the community house just to see what they offered. I took the bus Celia told me to take and walked into a building filled with white tables and chairs. Beige computers sat on some of the tabletops, and a row of beanbag chairs slouched along one wall like giant gumdrops. The receptionist asked me in Spanish, Are you here for the English class? English class? I'm sorry. Our new session starts today, so I just assumed that's why you were here. I was about to say no, but I stopped myself. Maybe it was luck that brought me here, or maybe it was providence. I envisioned myself in the school uniform I used to wear when I was a girl. The starched blue shirt and navy vest, the pleated skirt, the knee-high socks, and all of a sudden I liked the idea of being a student again. Maybe I would even learn enough to be able to help Maribel with her homework. Yes, I said, I am. The woman directed me to a room behind her. A few people were already inside, seated at desks, and they glanced at me as I walked in. I smiled at them and sat with my purse on my lap,
fiddling with the clasp until the teacher entered. She strode to the front and grinned at us with big horse teeth.
"Welcome, everybody," she said in English. "I'm your teacher, Mrs. Shields."
Of course, at the time, I didn't understand what she was saying. I only learned it later. That first day, the words were merely sounds in the air, broken like shards of glass. Beautiful from a certain angle and jagged from another. They didn't mean anything to me. Still, I liked the sound of them. No one in the class said anything in return. The teacher in Spanish this time said,
"Hola, todos."
"Hola," a few people replied. She put her hands on her hips.
"We need to wake you people up," she said in Spanish. "Hola."
She cupped one hand to her ear. More people responded this time.
"Hola,"
she yelled once more.
"Hola," I said.
Professora Shields threw her hands together.
"Terrific.
For today," she explained, "I'm going to speak in Spanish, but as the class goes on, I will speak it less and less. That will be okay, because you'll understand English more and more. You see? This is how it works." She used her hands to mimic a scale. "Less and less," she said, lowering her right hand. "More and more," she said, raising her left. "Now, some people will tell you that English is a difficult language. But don't let them scare you. I congratulate you for being here at all and for having the courage to try. Bravo! Give yourself a round of applause." We all looked at one another.
"Go on," she said.
We clapped lightly. Is this what Maribel was doing in her school, I wondered? Is this what school was like in the United States? It was like theater. Professora Shields called out greetings and had us repeat the words.
"Hello."
"Goodbye."
"My name is..."
"What is your name?"
"How are you?"
"I'm fine. And you?" Then she split us into groups of two and told us to practice. I was paired with a woman named Dulce, who was missing some of her teeth, so when she spoke, she bowed her head self-consciously and directed the sounds at the floor. I asked her in Spanish, "Where are you from?"
"Chiapas," she said.
"Eres mexicana?" I asked. She nodded.
"Hello,"
I said in English, trying out the syllables on my tongue. Professora Shields had told us to pronounce the letter H, even at the beginning of words.
"I know it won't sound natural to you," she said, "but you need to work to get it out. It's important."
I repeated the word.
"Hello."
In Spanish, Dulce said, "My son lives here with his wife. They brought me here." She peeked at me.
"Hello,"
she tried. "I came from Michoacán," I said, "with my husband and our daughter. My son's wife just had a baby boy."
"Felicitaciones."
"That's why they brought me, to help take care of the baby."
"What's his name?"
"Jonathan." I wanted Carlos, but they said no. He's an American baby.
"Maybe Jonathan Carlos," I said.
Dulce smiled.
"Hello,"
she said.
"Hello.
How you are?" she asked.
"Fine. And you?"
English was such a dense, tight language. So many hard letters like miniature walls. Not open with vowels the way Spanish was. Our throats open. Our mouths open. Our hearts open. In English, the sounds were closed. They thudded to the floor. And yet, There was something magnificent about it. Professora Shields explained that in English, there was no usted, no tú. There was only one word, you. It applied to all people. Everyone equal. No one higher or lower than anyone else. No one more distant or more familiar. You. They. Me. I. Us. We. There were no words that changed from feminine to masculine and back again, depending on the speaker. A person was from New York, not a woman from New York, not a man from New York, simply a person. I was still thinking about it as I got on the bus after class, mouthing the words while I sat, trying to accustom myself to the feel of them on my tongue, the shape of them as they escaped into the air. Professora Shields had given us all pocket-size Spanish-English dictionaries to carry with us so that we could look things up with ease. Practice, 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 she urged. I turned the tissue-thin pages, reading words at random. To trade. Cambiar. Blanket. Cobija. To grow. Crecer. Outside, a light rain had begun to fall, and after a few minutes, I closed the dictionary and watched the drops of water skid diagonally across the window as I listened for the driver to announce Kirkwood, which was my stop. But after a while, longer than it had taken on the way there, he still hadn't said it. I sat up in the seat and looked around. Were we on a different route? I rubbed my hand over the foggy window and peered out. But of course I didn't recognize anything. Relax, I told myself. The only reason you don't recognize anything is because you don't know anything here yet. I stayed put for a few more stops, fixing my gaze out the window while the bus rumbled along. I watched people get off, still more people get on. The driver shouted out other words, but never anything that sounded like Kirkwood. The man sitting next to me was wearing a watch that read 1:57 in small, glowing numbers. Maribel would be home at 2:15. I was supposed to be there to meet her when her bus dropped her off. Panic fluttered in my chest. What was I going to do? I must have gotten on the wrong bus. I had a feeling I was only getting farther and farther from the apartment now. I had to turn around. I stood and tugged the cord that ran above the seats. The bell dinged. I squeezed past the man next to me and walked to the front of the bus, trying to stay calm. The driver pulled over and opened the doors. Now what? I thought once I got off. I was standing on a deserted road in the rain. There were no houses or buildings as far as I could see. Only wheat-colored fields, patchy with dirt and cracked wooden telephone poles with drooping black wires strung between them. Dios, I said to myself. Where was I? Why had I decided to get off the bus in the middle of the country? I could be killed out here and no one would know the difference. I shivered. Then I forced myself to laugh. Who was going to kill me? The telephone pole? Before long, I heard a sound and looked up to see a car approaching. I watched as it neared and got louder, then sliced by and faded into the distance again. I told myself, it's a good sign. If there was one car, there will be another. You just have to wait. The rain was falling harder now. My hair and clothes were damp, and I crossed to the other side of the street and stood, clutching my purse. Maybe I could call the school and tell them not to let Maribel get off the bus if I wasn't there in time. The translator, Phyllis, had told me that for students Maribel's age, the school didn't require that anyone be there to meet them. She was allowed to get off the bus whether I was there or not, But maybe if I explained that this was a special circumstance, maybe the bus driver would wait. I dialed the school, and when a voice answered, I said in English, "Hello?" "Hello," the woman on the other end said. I didn't know how to say, "I'm looking for my daughter," so I just blurted out her name. "Maribel Rivera," I said. "Hello," the woman said again. "Is there someone there who can help me?" I asked in Spanish. There was silence from the other end. I reached in my purse and pulled out the dictionary, flipping through the pages to find the English word for help. The woman on the other end said something I couldn't understand. In Spanish, I said, "My name is Alma Rivera. My daughter Maribel goes to your school. Is there someone who speaks Spanish?" I waited for a response while I fumbled again with the dictionary, searching for any word that might make a difference. "I need to speak to someone," I said. "I need the bus driver to wait." The woman said something else that I couldn't understand, and I nearly wept in frustration. They were only words. I had the sense that I should have been able to unpack them, that there was only a thin veneer separating me from their meaning, and yet the veneer was impenetrable. A second later, I heard the clap of plastic against a hard surface, as if the woman had put the phone down. I waited to see if someone else was coming, someone who could help me. But what I heard next was the beeping of a disconnected line. In a fit of defeat, I threw both my phone and the dictionary to the ground, watching them skid and spin across the wet pavement. Why hadn't I called Phyllis instead of the school? I was wasting time. But when I picked up the phone, the screen showed that there was no reception. I held it up like a torch and squinted. Still nothing. Even after walking a few steps in every direction, I couldn't get it back. Chingala madre! I should have known better. It was a cheap piece of plastic. But it was all we had been able to afford since Arturo had insisted that we buy two, one for each of us to be able to use while we were here. Rain pattered against the ground like the sound of applause. The pebbles along the shoulder of the road where I stood were slick and glistening. Weeds bent toward the earth. I crossed my arms over my chest to cover my blouse, which was wet enough now that anyone could have seen through it to my bra. Then uncrossed them again when I remembered there was no one here to see me. What time was it? How long had I been out here? I imagined Maribel getting off the bus, standing in the middle of the parking lot, her backpack hitched high on her thin shoulders, confused because I wasn't there. Then I imagined the boy from the gas station skating up the way he had the other day, looking for her, and dread welled inside me. Why hadn't I stopped that car earlier? I should have run into the middle of the street, waving my arms. I shouldn't have let it pass by. Frantically, I scanned the road in both directions. I started walking, glancing over my shoulder every few seconds to see if perhaps another car was coming down the road behind me. I jogged for a while until I was out of breath. How late was it now? I checked the phone again, but there was still no reception. I punched all the buttons and held it to my ear, praying for a tone. But still nothing. I leaned my head back and screamed at the sky. A useless scream. No one could hear me out here. And then I started crying, my tears falling as dully as the rain. I heard it before I saw it. The rumble in the whirl. I stopped and turned around. A bus. It wasn't just a mirage, was it? Was it the same bus that had dropped me off before? Didn't matter. It was going the opposite direction now, the direction I needed to go, and it was coming toward me. I waved my arms and started crying harder. In Spanish, I yelled, "Stop!
Please, stop for me.
I didn't care that the driver wouldn't understand what I was saying. He would see me and stop, wouldn't he? And when he did, I stood on the road and shouted up at him,
Kirkwood?
He nodded, and I stepped up onto the bus. 20 minutes later, I arrived, soaking wet and shivering at my stop. I ran so fast to the apartment that my lungs burned.
Maribel!
I yelled as I flew into the parking lot.
Mari!
It must have been 2:45 by then, maybe later. I dashed up to our front door, but it was still locked. Through the window, I could see that the lights were off.
I turned and shouted again, Maribel!
I thought someone would hear me and open their door, Nelia or Inez or Fito if he was home. But to my dismay, no one did. I stood on the balcony and scanned the apartments, wondering if Maribel was inside one of them. Maybe someone had seen her and brought her inside. Celia, I decided, I should try her first. I hurried so fast down the wet metal staircase that I nearly slipped, but as I started toward the Torres' apartment, suddenly there she was. And right behind her, Mayor Toro. I gasped and ran to her, lifting her sunglasses off, cupping her face in my hand, studying it for breath.